Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today, I have a really interesting guest who is very multifaceted, but he has one particular crop that is the main focus of his love for breeding plants. He's a tomato expert and an amazing one. So today we're talking to Justin Sendriu-Williams from the UK. I'm trying to think what else I know about you. I just recently learned that you play shakuhachi and teachers.
Yeah, that's right.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Specializing in regional styles, old regional styles from the Edo period.
Lovely. Yeah. And well, I'll throw over to you to tell me more about like who you are and how you got into the world of crop breeding.
Okay. Well, crop breeding. I always cared about the environment, like since I was a little kid. Actually, I grew up in a village and I had assumed that eventually the village would be like city, kind of all paved over, because I saw things expanding and expanding, and even the woods just across the way, I saw them shrinking and shrinking as the brick factory, you know, dug up the clay and cut down the trees and everything. So it's all quite sad. I wanted to be like an activist or something. So yeah, I've always been concerned about other species. And sure enough, you know, it's been getting worse and worse and worse. And it was pretty depressing, really. And then finally, I thought, well, I should try and do something positive. Maybe I can. I kind of gave up hope for the rest of the species. I mean, obviously, some species are going to survive, but I think a lot are going to be gone. But I thought, well, maybe I can do a little bit for the human species, you know, maybe increasing food stability. So yeah. And I like tomatoes, and I lived in Japan and tomatoes were quite expensive. Like, I'd like to make a tomato sauce with our breakfast. So usually we just have like one tomato to share between us. Sometimes the prices went too high, I'd substitute in tamarind instead. And there's so many wild crop relatives for tomatoes that we can cross with varying degrees of difficulty. So it's quite accessible to breed with them in interesting ways and increase resilience. Plus they're like so popular and exciting to, you know, oh, I have a new tomato. Oh, great. Oh, I have a new pea. Oh, okay. Thanks, mate.
try breeding Queensland arrowroot. That gets people really thrilled. They have to be practically dead before they want to eat that one.
Yeah. Plus, it's a hard crop to grow in England. Mm-hmm. So I figure, like growing outside here, I spoke to a lot of people like in allotments and stuff, for example, like, do you grow tomatoes outside? Some people were like, no, and in the greenhouse, or some people would be like, well, I grow some late blight resistant ones outside and they don't taste good, but like I grow some of them outside. And then my tasty tomatoes I grow, like my heirloom tomatoes I grow in the greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if I could make it possible to grow them or easier to grow them outside, extend this season with disease resistance and general neglectability, so that people with fewer resources can grow them.
Mm.
Plus, you know, just using less inputs is better for the environment anyway.
Now, you have quite an extensive botanical and agronomical knowledge, which is unusual, but I think it's a trade-off for focusing on one species. Do you want to tell us your picture of the history of tomatoes?
Sure.
I think a lot of people who grow tomatoes don't realize they've got this really interesting backstory about where they came from.
Yeah, it's maybe not 100% settled in academia, but the way I see it is quite many thousands of years ago. I don't know if it's like 10,000 years ago, or I'm not sure exactly how long ago. It seems like in Ecuador, there was Solanum pimpinellifolium, which has like a 1 gram fruit. It seems like humans domesticated that. It might have been that some of the pimpinellifolium were coming into the sort of rainforest area, so there might have been some populations that were, already becoming a little bit different. But anyway, somewhere along the line, I guess you'd have humans just eating, picking wild berries, shitting around their encampments. And it seems like agriculture there was not as black and white as like Eurasian agriculture. The division between domesticated plants and wild plants is maybe not quite so clear. The division between sort of domesticated land and wild land also maybe not so black and white. What do people talk about, like food forests and stuff? Like maybe a lot of the Amazon was kind of food forest, a pretty strong relationship between the human activities and the forest. So, which we see in other parts of the world as well, like in some parts of Asia with like durian trees and whatever kind of thing. And so it seems like maybe you'd have like seasonal encampments, the people still kind of moving with the seasons and coming back. But you're bound to, if you're foraging, you're bound to favor picking the bigger fruits, because it's less time consuming, and then they're gonna be shat around your encampment and on the trails, the trade routes or migration routes. So gradually it seems like that was selected in that way to become maybe about 20 times bigger, and with seed size increase as well. And then somewhere along the line you've got movement into Mexico. Again, probably trading and migration and stuff. And so we could talk about genetic bottlenecks as well, because the first genetic bottleneck is that initial domestication. So we'd say Solanum lycopersicum, VAR, however we want to say that, Saraciform.
Which just
And
means
then,
like a cherry
yeah, like
sized.
round shape, basically. And I don't think they all are completely round shape, but yeah. And then you've got that, so a second genetic bottleneck, with some of those coming up into Mexico and then ending up becoming bigger, maybe up to like 100 grams or so. And then Europeans brought those Mexican, or some of those, so you got a third genetic bottleneck to Europe, and then basically all the world's tomatoes come from the European ones. I mean, you've got a bit of crossing, you've got things like Stapis, or Stapik. I don't know how to pronounce that properly. It's like a famous tomato. It was one of the first like late blight resistant ones. It's probably got PH1 in it. That had a bit of pimpinellifolium in. So you got some, and that was like in the 40s or something. I don't know. Does that kind of summarize the domestication process?
It's we've ended up with the tomatoes that you get from a nursery or a seed catalog are probably one of the most inbred narrow genetics crops. Even though they have superficial differences, they've got different colors and shapes, but the foundation of that population is one of the narrowest of any crop.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of phenotypic variation, especially in fruit, but a very little genetic diversity.
And the result of that is you get all sorts of diseases that have evolved for those kinds of tomatoes that make it really difficult to grow in some places.
Well, let's think about that. So Yeah, there is very little genetic diversity, especially in heirloom tomatoes. Actually, the situation has reversed a fair bit over the last decades with a lot of commercial breeders and smaller time breeders crossing with wild species. For example, you get these anthocyanin, like a sort of purplish or blackish skin. It could be a whole thing or it could be just a bit. That's coming from, I think they got that. I can't remember if it was Solanum Galapagos or Solanum cheesmani, probably Solanum cheesmani plus Solanum chilense. One gene from each. And that they're all about the place now, right? So that's an example of introgressions from wild species. And a lot of the disease resistances, like the PH1, 2, and 3, the now it's mainly 3 that's useful, 2 still a little bit for a late blight. They're all coming from Solanum pimpinellifolium. You've got various other disease resistances, or nematode resistance, or all these kind of things coming again from wild species. So there is a lot more genetic diversity now, although as the commercial approach is like, okay, we'll identify what's the most resistant gene in that wild accession that gives it that resistance, and then we'll use marker selection, and then we'll try and take just that gene and keep on backcrossing and backcrossing, backcrossing until we've got like nothing else left but that introgressed gene. You're going to pick up other things along the way, so it's never just one gene. But
And then they plant a
yeah, it
million
does give
acres
us.
of it, and the diseases become resistant to the resistance factors pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's tricky. Oh well, so I wanted to mention, because some people think, okay, all you need is genetic diversity, and then all your problems are solved with diseases, and that's completely untrue. You could have, there is, for example, Joseph Lofthouse makes wonderful tomatoes with a lot of genetic diversity that completely decimated by late blight, like in maybe often more so than like normal heirlooms even. And that's because he doesn't have late blight where he is. Or another example, Solanum peruvianum is probably the most genetically diverse tomato species. And I grew a patch of, I can't remember, it was something like 15 different accessions of Solanum peruvianum. So that's one little bag of seeds of just one accession would have more genetic diversity than the entire world of domesticated tomatoes. So like 15 of them, that's just insane diversity, and all completely decimated by late blight. So it's actually worth paying attention to specific resistance and okay, this specific population has resistance against Zeptoria or this and that, so yeah, it's not as simple as just having diversity.
Diversity is a possibility, not a promise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and from the diverse world of many species and many populations within them, we can find some resistances. Maybe we can, maybe m more can be developed if you have enough diversity and enough land to cross everything and keep selecting for years and years. Maybe new resistance can even evolve, but yeah, it's a little bit of a complicated situation.
It's also a question of like how far you can reasonably expect a species to change within a reasonable amount of time. Like if you're in
Yeah,
Canada and you
exactly.
want to grow mangoes, There'd be some mangoes that have some cold tolerance, but getting the generations turning, maybe if you're
Yeah, I
in
think
like
so.
Georgia, you'd have a chance.
Just kind of, it's kind of like teaching music. Yeah, you like I want to teach music that is difficult, but like within someone's grasp, you know, not like genius level, really difficult music to beginners. I want to teach music that people can play well in a reasonable amount of time, and once they're there, then bring them to the next step. So yeah, I guess same with plants.
It's like when I do a variety trial, like I won't do that unless I've seen a few varieties do reasonably well, but not quite good enough to actually want to produce on a regular basis. And then in a variety trial, I'm quite happy if, 70, 80% of them struggle, but there's a two or three standouts that like, yeah, there's something special going on with these. And yeah, if you get no good performance at that level, you abandon the crop, like you move on to something else.
Yeah, I see, if everything dies, it's a waste of time. What, even just one survivor, maybe it's worth it, you know? But yeah, if everything dies, you lost all your work, so.
Oh, so can you tell me about your tomato breeding project? So what are you working on? What are your aims? What are your strategies? How are you selecting?
Okay,
How did you source your
so
material?
so my aim is neglectable tomatoes, basically. Tomatoes that people can grow without much money in this region, basically. I mean, yeah, hopefully other regions too, but I want to, I'm pretty lazy, so I want to be able to just maybe grow a seedling. I mean, direct seeding would be great, but I'm not focusing on that right now. So right now I'd like to be able to grow some seedlings, and then after the last danger of frost, dig a hole, pour water in the hole, stick the plant in, and then never water it again. If it was completely self-supporting, that would be ideal, but okay, some minimal amount of support. And yeah, for it to basically keep giving fruit until the frost, maybe. That would be cool. So that's my aim, and not too tiny either, just like decent size. The medium is fine, medium-sized tomatoes. So they've got to be early enough producing, they've got to be big enough, they've got to have really good root systems. I don't want them to crack too easily. I don't want the slugs to like them very much. Like, I had some nice sort of thinner skin ones that just before they're ripe, the slugs eat them. And yeah, we could solve that by just picking them before they get ripe, but I'd prefer if the slugs wouldn't eat them.
Now,
Does that kind of summarize it?
I've got a rough idea. So do you have any general advice on people starting these kind of projects, like where you can go looking for material to start trialing and breeding with?
What, if you want to breed with wild species or
Well,
what?
if that's a part of the mixture, like what's the full range of resources that you've found to be useful, to be at least worth investigating?
Tatiana's database, there's a website, like, I can't remember what it's called exactly, Tatiana's Tomato Database, something like that. That's quite a good place to go for information on different varieties and stuff. They have grower reports, and so you can think a little like about the how early they are or what size they are and whether they did well and stuff. That's quite a nice resource. But yeah, I don't know, even people have different approaches, so I can't really say much. But my own approach is I want to work with domesticated tomatoes that have good traits. Like I said, with not cracking, taste real good, and as much disease resistance as possible. But then I want to work with wild species, which I wouldn't recommend to most people, I think, because it's like crazy amount of work. But again, the academic literature has is a great resource. People have done a lot of work, trialing so many different populations of each species for different diseases. And so that's, if you're trying to breed with wild species, crossing with wild species, if you just start from scratch, it would be kind of like, it would be like trying to play a really sophisticated traditional form of music, and not bothering to go to any teacher. It's maybe possible. You'll probably end up playing really poorly from the traditional perspective, and it will take you a really, really long time to end up playing pretty poorly. So you could just go to experts, and yeah, so with breeding, that means seeing what didn't work and seeing what did work. And okay, well, these populations of these species have what I want, so maybe I'll work with them. Or maybe someone's already crossed with them. Maybe I can work with their materials. For example, late blight resistance, we have PH2 and PH3 gene. I mean, I am crazy enough to work with the wild Pimpinella folium that has PH3 in it. But I spend more time working with domesticated tomatoes that already have that gene in. I'm now trying to work with the wild one because it has other genes, like sort of less strong genes in it that give it overall a stronger resistance. So I'm trying to kind of pick those up now as well. But yeah, but in general, if a lot of the work's been done already, why not
Build on it.
Take a very disease-resistant tomato that's already existing. There's new ones coming out all the time, and then cross that with like your favorite one that does well in your environment. And if you really want to, yeah, pick up some wild seeds from gene banks if you can. Gene banks are not accessible to like normal growers. You really have to be, in most cases, you have to be a breeder to get seeds from gene banks. But if you are serious in breeding, even if you're not like associated with a university or something, just be honest with the gene bank. Just tell them what you're doing and what you've done already and why you're doing it, and see, and maybe they will send you seeds. Just be honest and keep to their agreements and stuff and see what happens.
Now, I'm guessing you do a lot of hand pollinating, which for buzz pollinated solanums is a little bit of extra technique. Do you want to tell us a bit about how you approach that and like how did you learn to do it?
YouTube. Just watch a video to see oh, that's how you do it. Okay, that was it. 5 minutes well spent.
Did it
And
take you
then
many years to get really good at it?
no, like a few minutes, I guess.
Oh, there you go. What technique, like what tools do you use? Because there's different ways of recreating the vibration.
Bear with me, I'll be back.
Okay.
This is my favorite tool.
Watchmaker's forceps.
Oh my gosh, what have I done? Well, I've got a couple more pairs, but I've just seen those. That's recent. That's within the last few days. But you can see these are needle nose pliers. They're very, very sharp, and very precise. And the Switzerland Standard.
Nice.
They're made in China, but they're really good. And they're cheap. And so I can dissect a flower with these. Like, they're sharp enough that you can basically cut with them. So, I mean, domesticated tomato flowers are pretty easy. I could even just do it with my fingers, you
Yeah.
know, pull off the
Split apart the
stem
anthers.
stuff.
Yeah.
But with you know, try doing that on like a Solanum cheesemani flower, or even Solanum pimpinella folium is pretty tricky. They get real small. So crossing is way easier inside. So a lot of my crossing work, so I'm growing for low input outdoor organic growing, but a lot of the work is best to do indoors in hydroponics, which is like the opposite.
Is that more for
And I've even,
the specific crossing generations, and then you grow out outside?
yeah, suppose you want a population with massive diversity. So suppose you want to so suppose you want a hybrid soil. What you could do is you could just like get loads of different plants, plant them outside, and let natural pollination occur, and then plant all the seed. Or you're not going to plant all the seeds, because that'd be like maybe tens of
Millions,
thousands of
yeah.
seeds or millions of seeds. So you're going to just plant some of them. The thing is, with a, especially if there's a low outcrossing rate, that's really, really, really slow, and you're going to immediately lose maybe most or maybe nearly all of your genetic diversity. So my approach would be to, I don't know, suppose you want even just 10 different plants, you know, maybe all different sources. Grow them inside, grow them in small containers. So I was even growing in like drink cans hydroponically to keep the roots really small so that they flower real soon. And I'm growing with, you know, really good LED lights. By the way, the marijuana community are the community to go to if you want to know about good lights. They've really changed the whole the world of LED lights and made it really accessible for all of us. So if a good cannabis grower uses certain lights, then they're good enough for tomatoes.
Are you getting multiple seasons or multiple generations a year by using your greenhouse that way?
So right now I moved home, but I could get 3 seasons a year
Wow.
without difficulty.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference.
Exactly. So and that's done by this combination of hydroponics make things faster, small root space. There are some risks with that, but you know, that also, you know, maybe makes them flower quicker, and good light systems. So, and then being indoors, I would get, if they're like with the self compatible species, like Solanum lacopersicum, Solanum pimpinellifolium, Solanum cheesemani, and Solanum galapagens. There's at least one other, there's maybe two other self-compatible species, but let's say with those anyway, I could get nearly 100% success rate with crossing. It's really easy. In those controlled conditions. Outdoors, it's way harder. I don't know, for me anyway, maybe I'm just not good enough, but yeah, the success rate, you know, I have to do quite a few crosses to ensure that I get a cross. Yeah, and then suppose you grow 10, you could cross all 10 with each other, then you'd have, what would that be, 100 crosses or something? Yeah, you
Would
could
you
grow all that
do
one.
those all individually, and do you label like everything as you go, or do you do pooled pollen to like do it all in one
It
hit
depends what I want
sometimes?
to do. So if I wanted to create a hybrid swarm, then I would do them all individually. And then you grow out all the F1s, and then you could cross all them individually. You're starting to accumulate a lot of work there,
Do you know
but
what
then
I
you know you have all of them, and then you maybe have a lot of seed, and then you do what you want. And even in the so even for the F1, suppose you just made a lot of F1s, and then you planted all those seeds out, and did let nature take its course. But you might have an F1 that's really weak that could have really good success in the F2. So I think it's worth really taking great care of plants and of lines until it's actually appropriate to let them be selected by harsh conditions. Otherwise, just really, really quickly, you'll lose you might lose the best of what you had.
What I really love about what you're doing is that you're leveraging resources and technology that are available today in relatively accessible ways. But if you went back 50 years, LED lights and hydroponics were like science fiction. And depending on the way the world goes, 50 or 100 years from now, it might seem just as fanciful or expensive or impossible, and people will be forced to grow their tomatoes out in the ground, like dealing with the weather. So they'll need the genetics to be ready to do that.
True. I mean, if I were forced, if I were living before LEDs, I might make a system of mirrors or something so I could grow in the winter. There's maybe other ways around. But yeah, why not use what we've got available? I mean, you could take that step further. You could say, okay, why not use some marker selection? And I don't, but I wouldn't rule it out. I think that can be useful in some cases too. I like the idea of getting. I like the idea of phenotypic selection, partly because maybe there's a whole bunch of other stuff that can come through that we can really like, or that's just sort of hidden that might be useful
Yeah,
later.
you may not know
So,
it's useful until the diseases change.
yeah, or other things like. I really love the smell of Solanum chmielewski. It smells kind of lemony, the leaves. So I'm like, I want my plants to smell like lemons.
Have you read Rael Robinson's Return to Resistance?
Oh, is he the one who talks about horizontal and vertical resistance?
That if
I
it's just
looked
one
into
gene for
that.
resistance, it usually breaks down pretty quickly in practice.
Yeah, I found that idea interesting. I think it was his book that I read carefully about what he was saying about horizontal and vertical resistance, and it didn't actually make sense logically. I think he was saying which is the good one? Horizontal.
Yeah, horizontal is like it's multi-gene traits that are
Yeah, but
different.
actually, if when I looked into it, he's saying it might be one, it might still be one gene, or it might be more genes. And then the only clear definition he gave, and he didn't give any examples, and he didn't give any testing either. And the only clear thing he said is basically, vertical resistance is either like it's resistant or not, like there's no spectrum, and that horizontal resistance can't be broken through or something. So then if it is broken through, then that was vertical resistance. This is nonsense in my mind. One example would be the PH3 gene. It's not immune or not immune. It just gives some resistance. And all the late there's no late blight resistant gene that for domestic tomatoes, sorry, I shouldn't say gene. Like the most late blight resistant tomato plant I've ever come across is LA1777. It's an accession of Solanum habrochites. And the first year I grew it, oh, it got zero late blight. It even survived the first frost, and then finally it died. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. And last year I grew it decimated by late blight. Oh,
Oh.
damn. So what does that mean? Now then, because it died, then it was, oh, it never was horizontal. It was always vertical. So it's not like,
Yeah.
no. And you can have a whole bunch of genes. I don't know. Basically, I like the idea, but the way he explained it was not logical, and just and there were I was dissatisfied with that.
Do you think there's any potential for manipulating the late blight pathogen population so that it
Oh.
doesn't target the tomatoes?
Oh, I think that sounds like a really bad idea.
No,
Like,
I'm thinking more like a, you know how you use trap crops that the pests go
oh,
on, similar to that, but
it
some kind
blows
of,
for miles and miles on the
well,
wind.
I'm hypothesizing that you could grow a species that has a kind of late blight that loves it, that it tolerates, that doesn't, and the blight isn't interested in tomatoes. So you end up with the
But that's why
soil.
I'm bringing up that it travels for miles and miles and miles in the wind.
Yeah.
So if you imagine the whole air is filled with late blight under, conditions of certain humidity and temperature,
There's no getting away from
it's
it.
like it'd be
Yeah.
kind of like standing in the street with like a massive, I don't know, cloud of carbon monoxide just flooding the whole country, and you've got like a carbon monoxide absorber like in the town square or
Yeah,
something.
it's not gonna work.
Well,
I'm
maybe
grasping at straws here.
a
What
millimeter away from it, but I don't think we can change the pathogens. I think we can change the plants.
Yeah.
And
Are
I
there
mean, maybe
any wider hybrids? Yeah.
speaking to the idea of this horizontal resistance concept. I think I just dismissed that concept, but if we just talk about genes, the more genes we have that have some resistance, the better, I
Yeah,
think.
yeah.
And some strains of late blight, some genes will be better against some strains than others. And there's like infinite number of strains yet to come, of course. It rapidly evolves. So my approach really is to, I think I have a dual approach. One is to try to get different lines or populations that have different resistances to late blight. I mean, still trying to get them established. Like I have some, for example, I trialed like 16 kind, was it 16 or 18 kinds of Ceratiform from well and the bigger domesticated ones from Ecuador and Mexico and Peru last year, and I chose them on the basis of weather patterns. So I had a look on, okay, where, especially in Ecuador has the highest diversity. So I was like, okay, where in Ecuador is like the wettest, the most likely to have late blight? And then Mexico is like late blight central. I think they have the highest diversity of late blight there as well. So again, weather maps. And out of those 18 kinds or how many kinds, I found, I don't know, maybe like two with quite impressive resistance, and maybe another two with still fairly impressive, and then maybe another three that had nothing worthy of much celebration, but more resistance than normal domesticated ones. So then trying to bring, so even the ones that are not impressive, but maybe cross that with pH 2 and pH 3 tomatoes, then that could become impressive. And they were larger, I say larger tomatoes, maybe like 100 grams. So that could be worth, adding. And then the other ones with stronger resistance, not quite as strong as pH 2 and pH 3, but then okay, maybe try to bring them into a larger tomato, get that stabilized in the larger tomato, and then at that stage, try and cross that in with pH 2 and pH 3. So kind of try and stack as many different, and without crossing populations, that'd be maybe easier and harder. Easier in a way that you don't have to like stack them all at once. You could just shove them all into the population. And as long as you grow enough of that population for enough time, then maybe give it its own chance of stacking the resistance.
Now, we usually spend some time talking about the name of the podcast, Zero Input. What does that mean for you? Like, what are your aims? Like, how do you strategize? And like you said, you're a lazy grower. You want crops that do most of the work themselves. So how do you approach all of that?
Well, I approach laziness by doing a lot of work, I guess. I haven't had a day off in it'll by Sunday it'll be 5 weeks. So yeah, I have a strange approach to laziness, I guess. But yeah, I don't really aim for a zero input, but like minimal. I was even a bit worried, like, I moved here last year and I'm growing in a field, and I built 8 10-meter long no dig beds, and that was a lot of work. I had to buy like rolls of cardboard and get 8 tons of compost delivered, and wood chip. So that's input. But I wanted to establish those no-dig beds because I'm lazy, because I don't really want to weed, or just, minimal weeding. So once it's established, it's pretty low input. Maybe put a little bit of compost every now and then to top it up or something. But actually, like a friend was saying, oh, you should do like put comfrey water and this and that, and oh, you should test the soil and stuff. It's like, no, I want to be lazy with the weeds, but I don't care really about anything else. And I plant like really, like I was planting, I think on average about one tomato every 10 centimeters or something, like crazy crowded, but welcome all diseases, and I don't really care about giving nutrition because I want the root systems to be good and all that stuff. That's because I'm focusing on breeding rather than focusing on production. But I got worried, like, a lot of people can't afford to make a no-dig bed. So maybe next year I might be on more land, and even for myself, I let to do an acre of like 20 centimeters deep compost, like that's like a lot of tons of compost.
No, never mind the labor of moving it all around.
It's heavy work. So I was thinking about doing a cover crop and crimping it, and exploring that idea. I think that it makes more time for the soil to warm up at the beginning of the season, because of the color. But yeah, I was thinking I should experiment with ways that are even cheaper, like even more accessible to people.
I guess as candidate strains, like outstanding strains, start to emerge from the breeding work, that would be where you could start experimenting with different growing methods to see how much they can tolerate.
I mean, I could do it straight away, I think. I have to take special care of some, like, for example, last year I wanted to cross with some giant tomatoes because size increase is a an important thing crossing with wild species, because that, it's going to tend towards really small tomatoes. And we can't, it's not the right climate to grow giant tomatoes outside here. So the community next to the farm where I'm growing had two polytunnels, and they kindly gave me a little space in one of them for a few, like, I don't know, six plants or something of giant tomatoes. And they had some other tomatoes in there as well. And so that was, to give them more warmth. And I was thinking protection from late blight. Unfortunately, that whole tunnel got late blight, and all
Oh,
my work
no.
on the giant tomatoes completely destroyed. I use their pollen for some crosses, but for some work with self-incompatible and unilateral incompatible populations, I need them as mothers. So that was quite sad. So yeah, there's, I'm intending to make some kind of greenhouse for breeding work. But for all the selection work, which is most of the grow, that can all be outside.
Do you ever use wood ash as an input for tomatoes? Because I've found in my experience, they absolutely love that really alkaline, high mineral, readily
Cool.
solubilized kind of input, and it's relatively low tech if you can find the biomass for burning.
That sounds cool. To be honest, I'm really not interested in inputs. Like, maybe I should be, but I don't know. I'm trying to breed like productive weeds, basically. So yeah, maybe at some stage I should, if I ever try and, make any money from tomatoes, maybe I should. But right now it's like just, yeah, let's see which are the best ones out of my neglect.
Now, I want to also ask you about how you coordinate with other breeders. Like, what's your social network like? Because I think you've started doing collaborative grow outs with some of your breeding work.
So some breeders I chat with, like my friend William in America. He's really, really cool, and he's been a real inspiration and help, bouncing ideas off each other and sharing what we're doing. It's just really nice to have friendly contact with good, nice people. Lee Goodwin in America, he's also a really, really cool guy. He's a very busy guy, so we don't chat much, but yeah, it's been great to share some information and stuff like that. And I've got some friends, in Europe. Yeah, so that kind of social contact, even though it's at a distance, yeah, like I said, bouncing ideas and just sharing what we're doing kind of brings meaning to it. It brings more positive energy to it, and exchange of knowledge. In terms of growing, yeah, this year is the first time I just and I th it was quite last minute. I just thought, yeah, maybe I should share some of my seeds. Maybe people would be interested in helping me select. After all, I'm trying to work for the community. Maybe the community would like to help. So yeah, I sent out about 4,500 seeds, I think, so far. Well, I say so far, it's pretty much the end now of sending out seeds for this season. And yeah, we'll see how it goes. Most of the people I sent to are plant geeks, so I have high hopes that I will get the seeds back for the ones that do well. Some are kind of more public. So yeah, some are through networks of geeks through like forums, or Facebook groups, or there's like a seed saving WhatsApp group for the local area. And then some are just like through like local community groups, or even like a UK tomato group. So, some of them are kind of more mainstream people,
Am I
and
right in
that's
thinking,
wonderful. They want to be
am I
involved.
right in thinking that tomato breeders are probably one of the most vibrant communities of like amateur vegetable crop breeders out there? There seems to be a
Yeah,
lot more
probably.
people who are like crazy about tomatoes, crazy enough to do breeding work.
Breeding work, I'm not sh I guess it's popular because tomatoes are easy to get excited about. Breeding. Yeah, I guess there are a lot of tomato breeders. That's true. Most of the people I'm sending to are not tomato breeders, but they are interested in they might be interested in seed saving or in food security or sort of local production of food, stuff like that. Like some people working on organic farms, things like that. Yeah.
And what have you told the people that you're sharing the seeds with that you would like back when they grow out all of this diversity? What should they be looking for?
So, a lot of people, I sent to them F2 seeds of specific, well, sometimes it's, how would you call that? Let's say sometimes I've crossed an F1 with another plant. So I don't know if you call that F2 or F2 2.5. I don't know what that's called. But basically, that's the kind of diversity in most of what I've sent out. A lot of it is with a focus on trying to get PH2 and PH3 homozygous back. Some of it is working on other resistance. Some of it is without late blight resistance, just working on like seed size increase. So usually I'm asking for like one main trait. For example, with late blight resistance, I've usually given them also a couple of seeds of Primabella, which is like the most resistant commercial tomato, as a control. So, okay, anything that does as well as that, send back. Or the size increase, say someone's growing maybe 40 plants of a cross with Solanum galapagans or something like that. Okay, it's giving back the largest fruited ones. If there's, and I don't want to go, I don't want to push them too hard, but like, okay, if there's like two or three that are all equally large, like send me back the one that tastes best. Or also look out for exerted stigma. If there's exerted stigma ones, okay, send those back. So yeah, usually like one main trait and then maybe a few others to watch out for.
I'm in a similar boat. I think we're kind of working in parallel. Like you're on a much grander scale with the tomato genetics that you're working with. But would you be interested in commenting on what I've done in the last year with tomato breeding
Yeah,
and what I'm
tell me
hoping to
about it.
achieve? So of the tomato trials that I've done of like heirloom varieties, the one that really stood out was Principe Bourgeoise. I don't know if you know that one. It's a little bushy drying tomato. Don't know if I'm
I don't
pronouncing it
know it.
correctly.
Well, I don't know most tomatoes. I
There's
mean,
so many heirlooms around,
I
but
have.
so yeah, it's a little low determinate bush with small, slightly larger than cherry size, but really dense fleshed. That was a main drying variety in Italy.
Oh, okay, cool.
But I looked into the background of it, and apparently it's one of the original Mexican varieties. And that might explain why it's about as vigorous as our feral Pimpinella folium that grows all over the place here. Like it turns up in goat paddocks and it doesn't fruit as well when it's out in the middle of nowhere, but it does enough to get around. When it finds its way into the vegetable gardens, you end up with like a 4 square meter plant that just is,
Right.
you can't even get into the middle of it to harvest it. So I was always really impressed by that wild vigor. But I also really like how well behaved the Principe Bourgeoise, this little bushy thing that fruits all at once, all to death. But that's the only heirloom tomato that's anywhere near that level of vigor for my conditions. So
Okay, cool.
I hand crossed in both directions the wild Pimpinella foliums with Principe Bulgaeus to get an F1. And then I grew out that F1 generation to let them self-pollinate or let the bees do whatever they want. And
Yep.
I got a whole lot of F2 seed, like masses of F2 seed. And I've just this year, I've started sending that. Oh, have I lost you? No. No.
No.
So I've just started sending that seed out into the community. And the instructions I've given people,
Great.
most of these will spread everywhere, like the crazy wild cherry tomatoes. But if you find any, it should be one in four that's nice and compact and doesn't spread everywhere. They're the ones that I want the seeds back from, so that we can create a diversified population of something that's at least has the most
Yeah, that
important
sounds cool.
characteristic of Principe Bulgaeus, that you can plant it in rows.
Is it determinate then? Okay, yeah, that's a mutation. I'm not sure how old that mutation is,
But it is
but that
recessive,
doesn't occur
right?
in wild tomatoes.
Yeah,
Yeah, and
it should be
it's.
recessive that comes back in the F2 to some degree.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's totally black and white. It might be a bit of a spectrum. But yeah, that sounds good. What the first thought that comes to my mind is the Solanum pimpinellifolium. Like, if I wanted to do that, I might try to get like as many accessions of Solanum pimpinellifolium as I could, and then grow them all out and see, okay, which of those do I like the best? You know, maybe for different diseases, or you said, do you have an issue with flies? Something about
Yeah, we
that.
get a lot of fruit fly.
Yeah, so like what accession of Pimpinellifolium does best for you? And then I might cross it with that.
If I can get my hands on some more Pimpinella volume strains, I'll keep my eyes open.
Gene banks are good. You know, a lot of the supposed Pimpinellifoliums out there are not Pimpinella. Well, they're maybe hybrids. Real Solanum Pimpinellifolium, the best way to tell probably is the seed size. They're real small seeds. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean, oh, you should choose a pure one. Just choose whatever. I mean, a hybrid might be better. And when I say hybrid, I don't mean F1 hybrid. I just mean, you know, something that's already been crossed. But what you're doing sounds great. Yeah.
Well, we can compare notes and see how we go with herding people around. I think you've got more people involved than I do.
You know what else I might think is, if I were in your position, I might do a second project, which is, if that one already does so well, like, but is already small, why not try crossing that with a much bigger tomato, maybe even a very big tomato, and see if you can get the good traits that you like from that in a bigger fruit rather than in a much smaller, you're going to get much smaller fruits crossing with pimp.
Well, whatever we have that I'm calling Pimpinella folium, the fruits on good soil are about the same size as the Principe Bulgaeus. They're about maybe an inch long maximum
Yeah,
if they're
that's not
really
yeah.
happy.
Yeah, Pimpinellifolium will be like 1 gram fruits.
That's what made me think
Yeah.
it's probably a Serraciform kind of selection already.
Yeah, a lot of what people call Serraciform are actually just domesticated tomatoes crossed with pimp. And it's hard to tell without like genetic analysis, it's hard to tell, okay, is this like an early domesticated variety from like Ecuador or Mexico, or is this just a hybrid? And even genetically, it might not be that obvious.
And whatever this wild form is, it was here when I moved here, and it's always just grown in cow paddocks and goat paddocks, completely
Yeah, no, so
untended.
okay, so if they're already similar size, then that sounds cool. On the other hand, if you would like size increase, if you want something that does that well, but you know, increased fruit size is kind of handy because it's like less work for people to harvest. So you could even try crossing both of those, or you could try crossing your F1s. of those two with a larger
Something big.
tomato,
Yeah. Yep.
and
See what
maybe you'll
happens.
get something also useful and different, another interesting line maybe.
Well, I've only got one relatively large tomato, and I don't think it'd be large by like, the full enthusiast levels, but I have it. It's from a very old, I can't remember where I got this thing from, but it's labeled as having some chilensis in it, and I don't know whether that's correct, but it has these interesting brown fruit with a kind of smoky flavor, and the vines are very vigorous, almost as vigorous as the wild Pimpinella folium, and yeah, the fruit are probably up to 2 or 3 inches across. And yeah, there's really lovely, rich, kind of smoky flavor to them, which is quite unlike any other tomato I've tasted. And
Interesting.
yeah, it's a bit of an oddity, and maybe I should be doing some crossing work with it too. But yeah, anyway, enough about me. We're here to talk
No,
to
it
you.
sounds cool. No, it's interesting.
Well, I wanted to get your perspective on it because yeah, tomatoes aren't a major focus for me. I've got so many other things on the go that, but it's been nice to finally give them some attention and see if I can just mess
Great.
around with them a bit. Now, we
Nice.
should probably start wrapping up, and there's two questions I like asking everyone at the end of the process. The first really fun one, if you could wave a magic wand and like fast forward through a breeding program and create something, anything, what organism would you kind of wish into existence?
Yeah, the main one would be like ne neglectable tomatoes, which is what I'm trying to do.
What would they look like? Like, what's your ideal plant?
I don't think it would be one, because it's nice to have diversity. Wasn't there some guy who's like really, really successful at marketing, and what did he? It's something about sauces. I don't know what kind of sauce, but it was like some kind of bottled sauce in America. And they were doing all these. I think the normal marketing approach was like try to, and you kind of give taste tests to the public and like, okay, which one kind of satisfies the most people? And he was like, no, let's make three sauces, and you're kind of covering three different tastes basically, and then you can sell a lot more. So it's same with tomatoes. Maybe you want like a really good cooking tomato, a good salad tomato, a good storing tomato, whatever. There's so many different choices. So be nice to have like a number of different kinds of tomatoes that you can like neglect. Just plant, never water, they don't get sick, and they produce for a long time. What was I going to say? Oh yeah, and I mean I'm trying to make some self-compatible ones, some self-incompatible ones, so we can have a lot of genetic diversity in a fully outcrossing population. And then I'm working on a population with unilateral incompatibility, based on Solanum chmielewski, which it's self-compatible, but it's, I don't know what percentage it outcrosses. It might be mainly outcrossing, or who knows, maybe 50-50 or something. That's enough for an evolutionary population. But if some growers only want to grow like a couple of plants or five plants or whatever, that's not going to work well for seed saving for a self-incompatible population. You're going to get inbreeding depression. You're going to get loss of S alleles, which is a whole other story. So if it's self-compatible, but mostly outcrossing, it can still be suitable for those people. But it's unilateral incompatibility means it can, well, in this case, it can cross with domestic tomatoes in one direction. They can receive its pollen, but no, Yeah, the domestic ones can be pollinated by Solanum chmielewski, but Solanum chmielewski cannot be pollinated by domestic ones. And why I'm trying to bring this trait in is to protect an evolutionary population from dilution from inferior developments. I shouldn't say inferior, but you could lose, for example, we need exerted stigma. You could quickly lose that trait if they start crossing with normal tomatoes, or various disease resistances, for example.
Interesting.
So yeah, what I would want is what I'm trying to do, and that's what I'm trying to do it, I guess. Yeah.
Another question I like allow asking is, what is your vision for the future of food in your community?
I think almost everyone's going to die. Probably through food shortages. I think that the international food networks are going to collapse to at least some significant degree, maybe within the next 5 or 10 years. I don't know. I mean, we saw just like one little, well, I shouldn't say little, one big ship in what canal is that? Suez or the Panama? I
Oh
always
yeah.
get
Yeah,
those two
Suez
coming
got
up.
clogged.
Yeah, and then I suddenly, loads of shelves are empty, and or in the pandemic, maybe there was like egg shortages, and I just heard it was because like one factory in Poland got shut down, and they make the cardboard for the egg cartons or something. And there's, but then think of like a drought for the wheat crop that supplies Europe or something like that. So yeah, I think things are gonna get real bad pretty quick. So local food production.
I kind of see England as the Rome of the Industrial Revolution, and eventually Rome became kind of a hollowed out husk of itself when all of the networks leading into it, of all the things that made it so huge and great and vibrant, eventually went away, and it just became kind of a ruin.
Japan, I was so shocked. Like, I lived in India for a long time, and I was so shocked at how expensive rice was in Japan. And then I found out they had like high tax on rice importation because they wanted to make sure that people still grew rice in Japan so that if things go bad, they can still feed themselves. I think that's really nice thinking.
Indonesia just recently did the same thing.
Cool. Yeah, it seems sensible. But I'm not involved in all those kind of things. But yeah, just if there can be more, I don't know, if we can encourage more people to grow food and more of the, there's so many fields just filled with like a few cows or a few sheep or nothing. Like, it'd be nice to see more and more small scale market gardens. Maybe we need to think about like greenhouses. I've been moving a 60-meter long commercial greenhouse for a month. Hopefully one day we'll get it put up. I'm thinking about that because I think the winters here are going to drop. Maybe, well, the most recent academics on it says maybe by 10 degrees. The summers might get a bit warmer, but that's going to be harsh. But yeah, also, yeah, more suitable crops. Yeah, the shit's going to hit the fan, and the more prepared we are with seeds, the better, I think.
Well,
Seeds
on
and methods, growing methods. Yeah, sorry.
it seeds and knowing how to actually use them, the
Yeah, and
two
not
have
just
to go
that, but
together.
like doing it already. Like you, it's not, it's like when all the food is suddenly gone, you can't think, okay, well, now I'll plant some crops. It takes a while for them to grow, So, and it takes a while to establish growing spaces. So, yeah.
Now, if people want to follow up with what you do or any recommended resources? I know you mentioned that database. I'll put that in the show notes. Are there any other kind of links and leads that you would like to suggest?
What do you mean?
Oh, like if people want to get in touch and like get
Oh,
involved
if
in
they
the
want to get
breeding
in touch with
program,
me,
yeah.
the easiest way is to actually message me, like send me a friend request on Facebook and then message me through there. Not everyone uses Facebook. I mean, if you want to share my email address, you can. I'm not so good at responding to email. I try to check my email, but yeah, those two ways are probably the best way.
What I would probably recommend so you don't get spam, I'll encourage people to email me because you can find my details
Okay, sure.
already on my blog, and then
Sure.
I'll vet people and send them your way. Or otherwise, Facebook is probably the first option. I think most people can get you through Facebook. And
Yeah, and
they can
I tend
read
to.
about your posts because you post a lot about what you've been working on.
No, not really, actually. Or do you? Have you seen a lot of posts?
I've
I
seen
don't
enough that
usually.
you caught my attention.
I sometimes post to groups like there's a permaculture, or was it plant breeding for
Plant breeding for permaculture.
permaculture?
Yeah, that's a great little
Yeah,
group.
or some groups on my main page. I don't tend to post plant breeding stuff, actually. But yeah, if you're really serious about things and you want to collaborate or have some questions, then yeah, I can try and find some time maybe to answer some emails and stuff.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, Justin, thank you very much for taking the time to tell us
Oh, no
all about
worries.
what you're working on.
Oh, thanks for asking. Yeah, and thanks for telling me about your stuff too.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.